morning. Good morning. This is Joanne Bowman, and you're listening to Voices from the Edge. Boy, do we have a lively program for you this morning. We're going to just be bringing guests in, moving them out, just in and out, hip-hop right away today. So we're going to start this morning talking with Charlie Burr, who is a longtime community activist, good friend of mine, and also involved with the voter-owned election committee. Friends of Voter on Election. And for all you listeners to Voices from the Edge, we've talked about voter-owned elections a lot. I remember talking to you when we were trying to get it passed through the city council. And so Charlie's here today, and we're going to talk about the state of voter-owned elections. In spite of everything that we've heard, is this a good system? Is it working? That's the question that we're going to answer for you this morning. And if you want to join us in the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. And then we're going to go and do a brief presentation with another great friend of mine, Tom Hastings, who's a professor with Portland State University and Portland Community College. And we're going to talk about an upcoming conference that's coming up May 5th and 6th. And so we're going to tell you a little bit about that, how you could get involved and engage, building cultures of peace. Doesn't it sound like that's way past due for us to do? And then last but not least, right around 8-ish, we're going to have a woman here from Amnesty International, and we're going to talk about some local meetings that she's been participating in around a laser use by our police department. And so that's the program today. It's a lot going to be going on, so stay tuned. We're going to jump right in. Good morning, Charlie. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, Joanne.
It is my pleasure to have you here. So now, you and I, we know everything there is to know about what's been happening with voter-owned elections. I think the rest of the general public probably isn't as in tune to what's been taking place. So tell us, does the voter-owned election system, is that system working for the city of Portland?
It is working. I appreciate the question. It is working. It is already reducing the cost of elections. This is its inaugural primary, mm-hmm. this May primary. This is the first time we're seeing it work. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the spending in some of those key races, already it's just simply a fraction of what it was 2 years ago. The reason we created this system is that the old big money system was broken. It was unfair. It heavily rewarded incumbents. But most importantly, it locked out a lot of everyday Portlanders from becoming genuinely involved. And just let me specifically tell you what I'm talking about. If you look statistically at every election since 1970, only five incumbents have ever lost re-election. Only five incumbents have ever lost. And mm-hmm. it's just very difficult to take on the status quo right. and to run a viable race. And that means whole communities out there are not really being represented and are not really being given a fair stake in the process. So that's what we have set about to change, and that's why we're so excited about this May primary. We have one candidate, Amanda Fritz, who is qualified, who she's the candidate you don't hear about with voter-owned elections because she's actually done it by the rules right. and has gone out and collected in 90 out of 95 communities, collected signatures to get on the ballot.
And that was neighborhood associations, right?
Yes, 90 out of 95 neighborhood associations. The other candidate in the race, incumbent Dan Saltzman, who supported voter-owned elections, he's not running as a voter-owned candidate, but he is voluntarily limiting his own spending to $150,000, which is the voter-owned elections ceiling. And he's also limiting the money that's coming into his campaign. He's not taking any more money than $500 per donor. And that's a big fundamental shift to what we saw just 2 years ago. So we're excited about it.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of incumbency, we also have Eric Sten, who's running using the voter-owned election system, which, as you said, has really changed how city council elections are taking place. But we're going to only be talking about this for a few minutes, so let's just get into the critics' questions, right?
Sure.
So, of course, you know, this is the first time the system's been used. Emily Bowles has been all over the newspaper.
Right.
Clearly, it appears that she did not follow the rules because the auditors actually, talked to her a couple of times since then. So as the general public watches this play out in the media, what's your assessment of what they should see with the Emily Boyle situation?
Well, one thing I think I can't stress enough is that Emily Boyle broke the rules of the system, how it's currently written.
Mm-hmm.
And there are going to be steep penalties for that. Already you're seeing that the auditor Blackmer has said you are not entitled to voter-owned election funds, and he has revoked. He has called for the revoking of those funds. She is in the appeal process right now. She's also been fined $10,000 for spending improprieties. She had more fines a couple days ago. There's strict safeguards in this system, but you know, really, everyone knew in the process that there would be startup issues,
right.
And that's one of the reasons they created the Citizens Campaign Commission specifically to review, as we move forward, review these issues and say, okay, well, this is an extremely unfortunate situation. How can we learn from this? How can we go back and strengthen the system?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that specifically the League of Women Voters of Portland, one of the coalition partners, mm-hmm. they're going to be calling for voter registration requirements and greater monitoring of cash flow to be thoughtfully and thoroughly reviewed by the Citizens Campaign Commission. It's unfortunate that Emily Boyle is obscuring all the other good
right.
things that are coming out of the system. And also that the people who are opposed to voter-owned elections from the start, people like PG&E, mm-hmm. Quest, Garden Gerber, Oregon Restaurant Association, the people who are opposed to minimum wage, have used this as an opportunity mm-hmm. to attack the system. But ultimately, it's not going to be PG&E and Quest who decide this. It's going to be voters of Portland.
Right. On that note, I noticed the Oregonian last week did a very interesting picture.
Yes. you guys I can't see
I'm
it.
I'm showing it around the studio,
the radio,
but yeah, you guys can't see it, but you have to trust me on that. So the Oregonian Ryan Frank did a piece last week that actually followed the cash flow from the Portland Business Alliance members, which are the organizations or businesses that made up the First Things First Committee that actually tried to repeal voter-owned elections. And what the picture shows is kind of how cash has been raised and spent by the PGE's Quest and businesses that are associated with the First Name First and where they've distributed their money. And if you were able to see this picture, what you would see is that, you know, clearly Jenny Burdick is a candidate of the PBA, and she's gotten money from the same folks who were putting money into the First Things First Committee. Dan Saltzman also was a recipient of money from them. But it's really interesting to just kind of, if you follow the dollars, because my rallying cry always is follow the money. And if you just follow the money, it becomes real clear who's behind what candidates and why they're behind those candidates. And really, are these the people that are looking out for Oregonians' best interests, or are these people who have some special interests that they're trying to look out for? The other thing that's interesting is, Charlie, you mentioned how radically money has been reduced in the city council race that's taking place now due to the voter-owned election system. And it's kind of funny because if you compare it to Multnomah County, where there is not a voter-owned election system and where there are re-election and election campaigns taking place right now, it's as different as night and day. You're talking about five times the money being spent for people to get elected at the county as compared to the amount of money that it's now going to take to get elected to the city.
Right. And, you know, what we designed is just simply a more level playing field for people to compete. It's not inherently anti-incumbent.
Mm-hmm.
It's not inherently anti-challenger. It shifts the power of voting to people,
mm-hmm.
not the special interest. And it's a good deal for candidates, too.
Mm-hmm.
If you really want to have a quality debate, you don't want to spend all your time dialing for dollars. But that's
right.
what happens under the old system.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the PB&A Jenny Burdick article. That's actually, we have that online at friendsofvoe.org, friendsofvoe.org. And it's pretty clear that there are people, the PBA is sort of ground zero for the repeal effort. I understand that, I mean, it's not a good deal for them. It limits their power and influence, but it's a good deal for everyday citizens who want to become more genuinely involved. And one thing I'll say really quickly, because there's a perception that this is something that City Hall just rammed down people's throats. And
right.
the reality is this was a product of a lot of grassroots lobbying over 30 community organizations, grassroots organizations, including Oregon Action, mm-hmm. League of Women Voters of Portland, Citizens Utility Board, Money in Politics Research Action Project, the Communication Workers of America. A lot of groups said, you know, we have to do something because the old system is unfair. Mm-hmm. And for over 18 months, they thoroughly vetted this system. It's part of a growing trend that you're seeing in Arizona, Maine, North Carolina. But they said, you know, how can we best make this work for Portland? Mm-hmm. And so everyday Portlanders can become genuinely involved and empowered.
I'm talking to Charlie Berg. He's with Friends of Voter-Owned Election. Give us a call at 503-231-8187 if you'd like to get involved in this conversation. And so one thing I wanted to mention, Charlie, is that in other places, there have been problems with the systems in the startup phase.
That's true, right? And absolutely. In Arizona, we've had more than 100 candidates run for office, and it's either two or three were in violation. These candidates were removed from office.
Right.
What we've tried to do is learn from other places.
Mm-hmm.
And the Citizens Campaign Commission is they will be making recommendations on how to strengthen the system. But I do think that the auditor is already strongly going after the Boyles campaign, for example. And yes, we want to create a more open and fair system, mm-hmm. but we take the accountability part of this really seriously. I mean, we're talking about public funds, mm-hmm. and there's zero wiggle room mm-hmm. for improper wrongdoing,
right.
Misuse of campaign funds. Mm-hmm. That is not the purpose of the system, and if you do that, you're going to get caught, and you're going to face steep penalties.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I said this a couple of days ago. You know, there are people that will stay up all night trying to figure out how to get free money. And so anytime you have a new system in place that people are unaccustomed with and they think, wow, there's an opportunity for me to get some free money here, I'm going to sign up and figure it out. And it's wonderful that the system has these built-in checks and balances so that when people do this, like Emily Bowles, I think will be good for voter-owned elections long-term. Because what that says to people right away is that, guess what? People are watching, they're counting, they're paying attention, they're holding you accountable. Because if we're going to give you public money to run for public office, we're going to make sure you're using that money appropriately. So
that's absolutely right. I mean, any system has people that will try to take advantage of it.
Absolutely.
A good system is one that catches them
right.
and punishes them
right.
and gets the money back.
That's
and
right.
that's what we're talking about here. I know that we only have a quick amount of time. I will say that you can get more information at friendsofvoe.org. And if you want to get involved, we have a strong grassroots education campaign right now. We're just going out, knocking on doors and talking to neighbors and talking about how the system is working
mm-hmm.
and how it is creating a more open, level, and fair playing field. If you want to get involved, you can call 503-283-1922.
Wonderful. And so the public education campaign is continuing. We're continuing to talk to people about it. As I've talked to people, most people, once you've had a two-minute conversation with them, love VOE, voter-owned election system. And they love it because they absolutely understand the connection between money and who gets access, who has the ability to run and serve in public office.
I think that's right. I mean, and that's the history of it in other states as well, that usually it's passed by a pretty narrow margin. But mm-hmm. over time, people really embrace it. Like, I believe that 80% of Arizona, which is not
that's
the most
right.
progressive
right.
state in the land, it narrowly passed a little bit less than 10 years ago in Arizona. But now over 80% of people are saying this is a better way to run for office. And I think that really speaks to its strengths, that it is bipartisan, that mm-hmm. it is rural, it is urban. this is something that Portland is doing specifically, but I would love to see it in other municipalities. And it really does work. Mm-hmm. And especially if you compare it to the old system. I mean, that's the real key point here. If you look at the old system, I mean, in 2004, the spending was out of control. Mm-hmm. I mean, over 70% of all the contributions that went into city races came from just 7% of donors. And those are in checks of $1,000 or more. And in that type of environment, it's very difficult for a grassroots campaign, for a grassroots candidate to have a fair shake.
Right. Well, I want to thank you very much, Charlie Burr, for being here today. Charlie Burr is with Friends of Voter-Owned Elections. And again, the number, if you want more information or you want to get involved or help with the education campaign, you can call 503-283-1922.
Thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Charlie. You have a great day.
You too.
We're just going to ease right over into our next guest and welcome Tom Hastings, who's a professor with Portland Community College and Portland State still?
Correct.
Okay, excellent, excellent. Welcome, Tom. It's great to have you in the studio today. And we're going to spend a few minutes talking about... an upcoming program at Portland Community College, right?
Yes, on the Cascade campus, a conference called Building Cultures of Peace. And certainly one of the key elements in that would be voter-owned elections.
Yes, it would be. Absolutely. Well, wonderful. So this is going. This is open to the public.
It is.
Is there a fee? Is there a mission fee of $45?
Well,
and then there's a sliding scale for students and faculty.
Yes, and low income.
And low income.
Nobody is going to be turned away.
Absolutely.
And obviously there are costs associated with bringing in, extremely fine keynote presenters such as our Friday night keynote. Speech will be by none other than Joanne Bowman.
I am looking forward to participating in this conference. And as always, you know, Tom, you should tell the listening audience a little bit about yourself, because you've been working on peace issues and the peace movement for quite a long time, right?
Since the late Jurassic era. Yes.
And so talk a little bit about that. I mean, I know that this is something that you're passionate about, and you live your life around peace, nonviolence activity. Of course, that's a little challenging nowadays with everything that's happening in the world. But let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, a friend of mine is a young graduate of the Earlham Peace Studies program out in the flagship Peace Studies program in the United States, the very first one in North America at Earlham College in Richmond, Indiana. And she said, well, you just make your living working for peace. That's just so wonderful. And I said, yes, and it only took me 30 years to craft that up.
So there was a long plan, a long-range goal there.
Yeah, if you follow the money, that's the problem with promoting peace, is that we aren't war profiteers.
That's right.
We aren't Halliburton, who, comes in to take advantage of conflict and in the theories of conflict resolution. We actually have a phenomenon we call the conflict industry. And when you have adversarial systems of conflict management set up, you have those who profit by participating in the conflict, even if they prefer destabilization.
Exactly.
They prefer a broken system because they profit. So, for example, just in the news this week, you look at Ground Zero in New York City, and they're about to turn the first shovelful of dirt, finally, and they've spent something like two-thirds of the money.
Wow.
Where did the money go? To the lawyers. You know, and the conflict industry includes the litigious minded lawyers. When you're looking at the court system, it includes the war profiteers, the weaponeers. It includes the corporations who can go into these areas and just absolutely make obscene profits, like Halliburton, etc. And you quoted H.L. Mencken, follow the money. That's exactly what the conflict industry is all about. And that's exactly why committing to peace is going to be one that, that commitment is one to a much more modest style of life. And so that's why systemically we have to begin to build that culture of peace. We have to get people to understand that merely wanting peace is very different from saying, I get to want peace and drive my Yukon or my Esplanade. No, we have to start to think in much more holistic terms. So I'm just going to, I'd like to give out the website because and the contact information, because I know you're on a clip along pace here today, Joanne.
Yeah, we're just moving them in, moving them out today. But
it, yeah, the information on the website is peaceandconflictstudies.org, peaceandconflictstudies, one word, .org. And that'll take you to the conference, to the registration, to the program. We're going to be featuring a number of just really incredible workshops all day Saturday, as well as two other plenary presentations from somebody who's coming in from the United States Institute of Peace Saturday noon. And then we have the National Chairperson of Physicians for Social Responsibility in the evening. We have two theater productions happening during this. We have Andrea Cano coming to talk about reform of media and a number of other. We've got five conference workshop rooms with workshops throughout the day, both focusing on the academic and the activist side of building a culture, building cultures of peace. And to give two other contacts for this, a phone number is 503-725-9060. And then an email for more information, too, is director@peaceandconflictstudies.org.
Wonderful. And so, again, that's Building Cultures of Peace, May 5th and 6th at Portland Community College Cascade Campus at 719 North Killingsworth Street. It sounds like this is going to be a fabulous conference, and I appreciate the opportunity to participate.
Thank you,
Joanne.
It's
going to be a blast, and you're going to come back next week, and we're going to talk a little bit about it as we get closer a little bit more.
Yes.
And just make sure that people know what an incredible opportunity this is going to be. Excellent. Well, thank you. I really appreciate you coming by this morning. And you have given out the website and phone number. And so I will do that again before the program is over.
Thanks,
have a
Joanne.
Fabulous day. You're very welcome. Again, Tom Hastings with Portland Community College for an upcoming Building Cultures of Peace. The Peace and Conflict Studies Consortium is hosting that particular conference. And now we're going to shift gears again. Boy, if you guys are driving, I know you must be freaking out this morning because we just keep shifting from one place to the next, to the next, to the next. But that's just the way it is sometime in radio. Again, I'm Joanne Bowman, and this is Voices from the Edge that we're listening to. Now we're going to shift gears and welcome my latest guest. And
Mona Cadena.
Hello, Mona. It's a pleasure to have you here today. And Mona is with
Amnesty International.
And so there's a huge Amnesty International conference here this weekend. It's starting today.
That's right. We're starting today with our board meeting, and programming kicks off tomorrow, first thing in the morning. We have an educational seminar for teachers. It's called Curriculum for Change, and it's looking at the issue of poverty and how to talk about and bring lessons of poverty into the classroom.
Oh.
And so that's happening all day tomorrow.
Wonderful.
And then we'll have a demonstration in Pioneer Square focusing on the issue of torture and particularly extraordinary renditions. And then we kick off for the rest of the weekend. So about 1,000 Amnesty International members from around the country and some international guests will be coming to Portland, and we're very excited to be here.
That sounds pretty awesome. So we've got about an hour if you could be here for the whole time. And so, and I know I've been directed to, you know, spend some time talking about tasers, but I actually want to start off talking about Amnesty International.
Sure.
Your relationship with Amnesty International. Are you local or are you from somewhere else? Are you
I actually am based in our San Francisco office.
Okay.
We have five field offices around the country, and so San Francisco is one of our field offices. And so I work in San Francisco, and we work with Amnesty International members from Colorado West, including Alaska, Hawaii, Guam, American Samoa. And so I get the opportunity to work with high school groups, middle school groups, community groups, and to help them be the most effective activists that they can be, both in their community and on the globe.
Oh, man, we need you here, Mona. You should just kind of move to Portland And I think we could have something really good we could start. So we'll work on that while you're here. You're listening to Voices from the Edge. I'm Joanne Bowman. And Mona, I'm sorry, what's your last name again?
Kadena.
Mona Kadena is here speaking with us from Amnesty International. And so how did you get involved with Amnesty?
Wow, that's a great question. I have been with Amnesty, gosh, almost 7 years now.
Okay.
And when I graduated from college, I moved to Washington, D.C. because I didn't really know what else I was going to do. And
right.
So I started interning with Amnesty in the Washington, D.C. office. And we started a campaign that was focused on the United States of America just shortly after I started interning. And one of the issues was women in prison. And we had some legislative goals. There were 14 states around the country that didn't have legislation protecting women prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, women were being housed with men.
Wow.
Women were being searched by men. And we found some horrible stories around the country of,
mm-hmm.
you know, women being forced to do sexual acts
mm-hmm.
in exchange for things like toiletries,
mm-hmm.
Soap, things
mm-hmm.
like that. And so we really worked. And now I believe in 14 of those states there is, while not a perfect law, at least a better law that
mm-hmm.
really recognizes that, you know, it's not appropriate to house women with men.
Right.
It's not appropriate for guards and inmates to have sexual contact.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really how I got involved in that. I started working on specific state legislation. So
wow.
my first job with Amnesty was to pass a piece of legislation in West Virginia.
All right.
So
you're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm speaking with Mona Kadena. Kadena?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'll get this right. Kadena from Amnesty International. That's a really fascinating story. I can tell you that in Oregon, we just, this past legislative session, finally got the law changed.
That's
so
right.
That prison personnel would be criminally prosecuted for having sexual relationships with female prisoners.
That's right.
Or with any prisoner
mm-hmm.
for that
and
matter.
Amnesty International members were part of that effort here in Oregon.
Yeah. It amazes me. I used to be a state legislator that we could not get that through. And I left in 2001 and I kept thinking, well, this is kind of a no-brainer. What do you mean that this we people will not vote for a law that actually says that this is not okay?
Right.
Yeah, with all the issues of power and position and everything, it just seemed really insane to me. But, you know, so this is 2006, so 5 years later, finally, it
right.
becomes law, which is...
Right, and, you know, Oregon was one of the 14 states
mm-hmm.
that we had targeted and actually was almost the last state to have its law changed.
And we pride ourselves on being first, but so much for that. And so now I understand that you've spent some time since you've been here meeting with our acting police chief, Chief Sizer, and talking about the use of tasers
That's right.
as a tool for law enforcement
mm-hmm.
to contain behavior. I understand that you've done some kind of, you've got some national information about taser use, and then I want to bring it down to kind of the local level
sure.
about your conversations here locally. So talk about tasers. What are they're being framed as a non-lethal mechanism to control combative citizenry, right? That's how
right.
they're sold to the public. So much better than us shooting somebody, because when we shoot people, they really get
right.
mad. The community gets in an uproar. So this is a safe alternative, is how the public has been educated on
right.
tasers.
Right. Well, you know, electroshock weapons have been around for, you know, more than a decade, and we have been, you know, working on electroshock weapons in the context of their use in torture worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 2004, we released our first report looking at electroshock, but particularly taser use in North America.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found was that there was really a rush of police departments to bring tasers to the street.
Right.
And it all came under the guise that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We need to stop police shootings. We need to bring our shootings down. And so tasers are the best option to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we really wanted to see how is it working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's going on with tasers?
Mm-hmm.
And so we found really two main concerns with the use of tasers. The first is how they're actually being used by police. As you say, they're billed as an alternative to deadly force.
Mm-hmm.
But what we know that in practice, tasers are often used in situations where you would never use deadly force. Mm-hmm. And they're used in cases if someone fails to comply to a verbal command. We see tasers being used on them. In many cases, we see that tasers are used on unarmed individuals. Mm-hmm. And so just a couple of months ago, we released an update to our 2004 report. And the big news in that report was really that since July of 2001, we document that there have been 150 taser-related deaths in North America. And we find that to be quite concerning. And that leads into our second big concern with tasers is what we see to be the outstanding medical questions. Mm-hmm. There have been studies and there has been research done on the use of tasers, but there has never been an independent study. Mm-hmm. All of those studies rely on information from manufacturers of tasers to do that analysis. And we believe that it's not fair to put tasers on the street when we just don't know what happens.
Right.
You know, we're talking about a weapon that has 50,000 volts of electricity. Mm-hmm. And we don't know what happens to the human body,
right,
you know, when you're hit with that much electricity.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. I'm talking to Monica Dina. She is with Amnesty International, and she's here for an international conference that's taking place here in Portland, starting today through the weekend. And so you've had an opportunity to meet with our acting police chief, mm-hmm, Chief Sizer, and share this information with her, I assume, was part of the conversation. And what was her response? How does she feel about the information that you provided?
Well, what was encouraging is that, you know, the chief and, you know, her sergeants had already seen a lot of our information.
Oh, good.
And, you know, they have been keeping up with a lot of the literature that, mm-hmm, has been circulating around, you know, mm-hmm, on the issue of tasers. I mean, Amnesty is not the only organization that's been writing about tasers.
Mm-hmm.
ACLU, mm-hmm, and you know, other groups are looking at concerns both with the medical, you know, piece and with the use piece.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we were quite happy that, you know, what we were bringing to them was not new.
Right.
And so they, you know, they seemed quite open, mm-hmm, to hear our concerns, and, you know, we have a set of recommendations that we want to see both local, state, and federal officers use as they deploy tasers on the street.
Wonderful. And we'll get into that in just a couple of minutes.
Sure.
But let's take a phone call, okay? Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I've been listening to the KBOO news, and they had mentioned that Amnesty International had sued Evergreen Aviation, or there's a lawsuit on Evergreen Aviation for extraordinary rendition. And I was wondering if Molly knew anything about that.
I'm sorry. Your question had to do with whether Mona knew anything about what?
Evergreen Aviation and the lawsuit Amnesty International has come.
Let's ask Mona. Mona?
Well, you are talking about the issue of extraordinary rendition, where the U.S. government is contracting private airlines to send detainees to countries where we know that torture is happening. Is that what you're talking? What you're asking about?
Right, and there's a local airline company in McMinnville.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
That is being sued by Amnesty International for ties with the CIA and using their planes for extraordinary rendition.
That's correct.
And I'm wondering if you know any more information or can talk about that at all.
About the case specifically, I can't talk specifically about it, but really the issue of extraordinary rendition is something that we are very, very concerned about. And, you know, essentially we look at it as the U.S. government outsourcing torture. And we do not think that it's appropriate for the U.S. government to contract private airlines to send detainees to countries that we know the U.S. State Department knows is complicit in torture.
Right.
You know, countries such as Morocco and Syria and Thailand,
right,
we know that those detainees have been sent to those countries so that, you know, other countries can do our dirty work.
And if we as local citizens know that these are businesses in our area that are involved in this, what should we be doing here?
Well, I think the first thing that you can do is let those businesses know that it's not okay with you, mm-hmm. that they are complicit with the CIA and the U.S. government in outsourcing torture.
And the other thing is just the fact that you're exposing them on the air helps a lot, right?
Absolutely. There's a lot more information on our website, amnestyusa.org, and we just released a brand new report about the issue of extraordinary renditions, and we look at private contractors around the country mm-hmm. That have been working with the U.S. government and, you know, providing their planes for their use. So contact these companies, and also you can contact your member of Congress and let them mm-hmm. know extraordinary renditions are inappropriate and it's never okay.
Exactly. And one other thing I'd suggest is actually to do a little research, find out who's on the board of directors of these companies. Write them, email them, make their life a living heck. And something will change.
Well, thanks for visiting Portland. We're happy to have you here.
Oh, we're happy to be here.
You had me trying to keep her here. You know, I'm trying to tell her she needs to stay. We need more Monas here in Oregon. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. I'm talking to Mona Cadena, and she is with Amnesty International, and she's out at the San Francisco office, and we're thrilled she's here in Oregon today. We've got another caller, so let's head back to the phone line. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, Kibu.
Good morning.
Thank you for Amnesty International and all representatives.
Thank you.
I just had this clipping from the paper and wondered if anyone had caught it. I believe it was in the Columbian Vancouver newspaper here.
Mm-hmm.
The story, cow endangering traffic dies from taser gun.
Wow.
A cow that wandered into traffic near a shopping mall was killed by Spokane County Sheriff's deputies who repeatedly stunned it with a taser. So they knew what they were doing.
Interesting. No, I hadn't heard that. Had you?
I hadn't heard that. But what's interesting about that is that in the what we consider to be the 150 taser-related deaths, what you'll see is that the majority of those were killed by multiple shocks.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, I think you just said that the cow was shocked multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
they did. They just kept hitting it because other ways of really corralling it or controlling it weren't working, so they were willing to literally do whatever it takes, including take it down.
Oh, it sounds like they fried that cow. So the question becomes, and so it goes back to your original point, right? Because the whole idea of tasers is it's supposed to be a non-lethal mechanism to control an unruly person that you're trying to arrest. Whose bright idea was it to use it on a cow in the first place is my question. You know, because it's like I'm pretty sure there have been no tests to determine what the impact of taser shocks are on cows.
Well, that's a pretty good test.
Point taken.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. You know, when we talk about testing and researching of tasers, mm-hmm. all the testing has been done on pigs and in some cases anesthetized pigs, and they don't do a whole lot to replicate the conditions under which a taser is used on an individual. You know, we're talking often about a police confrontation. Somebody's heart rate is up.
Right.
In many cases, they have ingested some sort of drug.
Exactly.
And, you know, when you add that extra shock, that extra jolt of a taser, you know, we know that that could be that exacerbating factor that really sends somebody over the edge.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those research studies, you know, those studies that rely on data from the manufacturer, all of them end up with this large question about the medical concerns.
Mm-hmm.
What actually happens? And even further down from that, they mm-hmm. say, and the more shocks you increase, the more it's like putting Russian roulette, you know, into the human body. Because at some point, that shock could hit when the heart beats just at the wrong time.
Right.
And then we can send somebody into ventricular fibrillation.
Wow. Any other comments, sir?
No, I think that was it. It was just an example of how serious this is, and it's just how it's used and the intent. And the spokesperson for the Spokane County Sheriff there was Sergeant Dave Reagan, R-E-A-G-A-N. So I don't know if you wanted to ask questions about that too and get a letter about it, because it is a test. It is an example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and of course, we had a recent person die here in Portland who was, if memory serves correctly, he was acting erratically, and the police used the taser on him, and ultimately he died in custody a couple hours later.
Right.
And then they found... It's interesting because what they I think what the headline said was cocaine, not taser, killed this individual. But it sounds like we don't know whether it was the cocaine in his system or the combination of the cocaine in his system with the electric shock that actually was what killed him.
Right, and I think that's true. And there are 23 autopsy reports around the country that note that the taser was a contributing cause effect in addition to often it's some kind of drug use, mm-hmm. methamphetamine, cocaine, etc. And there are 7 cases around the country where coroners have said that tasers were the primary cause of death.
Hmm. Wow. So there's some issues. So tell me what your recommendations are for taser use.
Essentially, we believe that tasers should be higher up on the force continuum or a high level of force, mm-hmm. Under deadly force.
Right.
Tasers are built as an alternative to deadly force, and mm-hmm. we believe that those are the situations in which they should be used. They should not be used on senior citizens, pregnant women, children at all. We mm-hmm. believe there should be a full-out prohibition. On another level, when you shoot somebody with a taser, if they have some other kind of underlying health concern, whether it's a heart condition or mm-hmm. even an implanted device like a pacemaker, mm-hmm. It's important for officers to do some verbal, questioning.
Mm-hmm.
We believe that information about how tasers use should be available to the public,
mm-hmm.
that you should be able to go to your police department and find out how many times was that taser sparked, mm-hmm. how was it used, and how long were those cycles. As I said, we know that the majority of taser-related deaths happen with multiple shocks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a 5-second shock, but as long as the barbs are connected to an individual, an officer can continue to reignite the taser for as many times as they want until the battery is dead.
Mm-hmm.
Or until the weapon is essentially overheats itself.
So it sounds like there's not a lot of training around taser use.
Well, what we know is that it's different from department to department, from state to state. There are no similar standards anywhere. And, I could, particularly in California, I could go from one town to the next and the police officers will use a taser on me differently if they were
mm-hmm.
going to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And the training standards are very different. Some departments require, 10, 20, 30, 40 hours of training.
Mm-hmm.
Others just require, anywhere from 2 to 5 hours of training.
Mm-hmm.
Some departments require that you be recertified in your taser use,
mm-hmm.
and others don't require recertification at all. So we also are very interested in looking at some minimum standards
mm-hmm.
for taser use and taser training. Additionally, we want police departments to bring in other forms and other sources of training.
Mm-hmm.
The manufacturer provides training materials, but we think it's very important for departments to supplement
mm-hmm.
those training materials from the manufacturer with their own experience,
mm-hmm.
And also in our ideal world, we like to see them talk about human rights standards,
right.
In those trainings.
Right. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. I'm talking to Mona from Amnesty International. We got a lot of callers, and they've got a lot of questions, so let's just jump right in there. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Hello.
Hi, I can barely hear you.
Well, I want to take issue with your guest talking about Evergreen Aviation.
Okay.
The man asked a specific question, and the lady indicated that she did not know whether anything about Evergreen Aviation's participation in this rendition. And in fact, I was listening to the BBC last night. They've got somebody in the European Union. They're quite active in trying to pin down the flights that went over the European Union that involved the CIA.
Right.
And the problem is they cannot get good evidence. They have 2 people, apparently, that say they were flown.
Mm-hmm.
2. And, of course, you might question those people, their background, but they got 2 people, and they're trying their best. But I think the thing is we're talking about extraordinary rendition, and this is a matter, I think, to put pressure on Congress, that apparently it's just very difficult to really pin the goods on these people, and to pick on Evergreen Aviation, I think, may be a mistake. Unless you really know that they've been doing something, if you know that, you better tell these people in the European Union they're trying to find out.
Okay, well, thank you. Let's get a response. Appreciate that question.
Well, you're absolutely right in that it is very difficult to find information about who's involved and, you know, what's happening. You know, we released a report in the last month that cites Evergreen Air specifically.
Mm-hmm.
We send, you know, missions out. We send researchers out, you know, around the world to research these issues. We do not print anything in any of our reports unless we've verified it by three independent sources. That Evergreen Air has been working with the U.S. government, has been verified by three independent sources by our researchers. So while I cannot talk about the specifics of the legal case, you know, I can tell
confident.
You that we know that Evergreen Air has been participating. But you're right, they're not the only ones.
So does that answer your question? Oh, he must be gone. Okay, we'll go to the next caller then. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
How are you today?
Oh, pretty good.
Excellent.
And I want to bring up a point that's brought up by the juxtaposition that you had. First, you had Tom Hastings on and talking
yes.
about the thing for conflict resolution.
Right.
And what my concern is that someplace in the last 40 years, is torture has become an acceptable police method. I remember being very incensed when I watched the movie This Is What Democracy Looks Like.
Yeah.
And the cops are telling people that there will be inflict pain on them and everything else. Well, in the 60s, they used to arrest people. They'd pick them up, and people would go limp, and they would arrest you, and they would cart you off and put you in a paddy wagon and take you downtown.
If you were white.
Right. Well, what happened is when you get downtown, they'd beat you up in the elevator. But, you know, like the last time Nixon or Bush, whatever that guy's name was, in town,
I saw them,
at the corner, they had this young man, he had his hands handcuffed behind his back, and they would ask him a question, and they didn't like his answer, so then they would raise his arms up and lift him up off the ground from being handcuffed
Ooh.
Behind him. And
so that's torture, yes.
Yeah, and this is my point, is that what is going on, and the woman from, your guest from Amnesty International, I was hoping maybe she'll address this. Or rather, the question is, what is Amnesty doing to address this point? That what is the whole idea about, you know, the cops are using tasers, it's fairly obvious, to torture people, and these are people who shouldn't be on the police force, actually. They don't have the right personality profile. They're just twisted little individuals. But this whole idea, why not, instead of tools to torture people, have the cops learn linguistic skills? There was a time when women started getting into policing 30, 40 years ago, that they would dissolve situations, you know, instead of escalate them. And maybe your guests can address that.
Well, good question. Thanks.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, one of the things that that Amnesty International talks about significantly is the issue of training. And we know that the better our officers are trained, the less we're going to have those confrontations on the street.
Absolutely.
And that's one of the big challenges with departments, because training costs money. And it's easy to cut training because you feel like we can't bring our officers off the street for 40 hours to do a conflict management training
right.
or to do a conflict resolution training.
Mm-hmm.
But what we know is, in the long run, it's going to pay off in spades.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting that you say that in talking to the police chief this week. One of the things that she talked about significantly is wanting officers to use their verbal skills.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she was very open about the fact that she felt like officers being verbally competent is a very important skill
mm-hmm.
that Portland police officers need to have. And we were very encouraged to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to, you know, the fact that the trainers at the Portland Police do bring in their own experiences mm-hmm. to the training. But, you know, we continue to call for more substantial training.
Right.
You know, international human rights standards recognize that police officers are on the front line mm-hmm. and they are going to come up in violent situations and they are going to have to use force. Mm-hmm. But what we want them to do is to de-escalate that as quickly as possible.
Right.
And your caller is totally right that the better our officers are trained mm-hmm. and the better their linguistic skills mm-hmm. and the better they are able to de-escalate that, the less likely we are to see them using force.
I want to let you know that I'm working with an organization called Oregon Action, and we're going to do a series of community listening sessions between the community and the police,
mm-hmm.
Trying to answer the question about whether or not racial profiling is a mechanism that Portland police officers use in their interactions with people of color and recent immigrant communities. They're going to start mid-May and run for 5 weeks, so they'll be in each of the precincts. And I must say that the new police chief and the one that's on leave were both very supportive of this effort and really believe that the end result is to create better communication between the community and Portland police officers. And as far as I know, we've never done anything like this before in Portland, and so I'm really looking forward to us having that dialogue, because I think it will be one of the first times that there's not a recent shooting that the community is responding to, where you could bring community members and police officers together and actually have the police listen to the community's experience and have the community listen to what's in their training, policy, and instincts leads them to make these stops, whether they're a pedestrian or a traffic stop. So I'm looking forward to participating in that, and I'm hopeful that that's one of the pieces that moves us along to having a better communication between communities and Portland Police Bureau.
Absolutely, and that's such an important forum to have for the community, particularly mm-hmm. to do it outside of an emotional situation
yes.
when there's been a shooting or mm-hmm. a violent incident or that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing. And it's,
right.
Being able to open that dialogue. I mean, mm-hmm. we've seen in other cities around the country, Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. Prince George's County, Maryland, that mm-hmm. when we start to open that dialogue,
mm-hmm.
We start to see better policing.
Right.
And, I know, in talking to police chiefs who I work with across California, mm-hmm. those that have started moving to a more community policing model
mm-hmm.
are starting to see better relationships between police and the community. And the community is less afraid to call the police when they
right.
might need them because
right.
they feel like the police might actually hear what they're having to say rather than are going to come out and automatically think that they're at fault for
right.
something.
Right, right. I'm curious, Mona, about what is because Amnesty International works around the world,
mm-hmm.
right? Since 9/11, since this administration has been in office, what has been what is Amnesty International seeing as far as how people internationally relate to the U.S. nowadays? Is your job more difficult because of the current administration, or does the current administration actually have more people running to join Amnesty International?
I guess yes and no. I mean, it certainly seems to have brought things to a flashpoint much
mm-hmm.
more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember last year when our annual report was released, our Secretary General called Guantanamo the gulag of our time.
Uh-huh.
And that was like a firestorm around
uh-huh.
the country. And,
uh-huh.
Suddenly, it felt like people were sitting up and waking up and just were like, oh, my gosh,
right.
a gulag. What are you saying?
Right, right.
And it was that really, for us, I think, was a turning point in that.
Mm-hmm.
For the first time since 9/11, we started to get, normal citizens, everyday regular
right.
citizens that don't go out and demonstrate regularly,
right, right.
That aren't, up in arms, that were actually thinking about what their government is doing around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And what is it doing to our relationship with other countries?
Mm-hmm.
And how is it affecting our foreign policy?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think in the past couple of years, I think we're starting to see that people are starting to ask more questions
mm-hmm.
of the administration and are really starting to be concerned that the United States of America is participating in policies and practice that are counter to why the U.S. started in the first place.
Right.
I think, there were many of us shortly after 9/11 that were saying to ourselves, oh, my God, it's so hard for me to love this country.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. I feel like I could die for this country, but suddenly I'm ashamed of what we're doing.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of folks who are starting to think about that. So it's slowly, I think, starting to come around. We're starting to see people asking more questions.
And I think that's a great thing. Whenever people ask more questions, it's because they're seeking better understanding, which means that hopefully once they get all the information they need, they're going to make some really good choices. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. I'm talking to Mona Cadena, and she's with Amnesty International. Good morning, caller. Welcome to Cable.
Well, hey, Joanne.
Hello. How are you today?
I'm great. This is old LJ. Hi, Mona.
Hi.
Mona, listen. The money order Amnesty International is in the mail.
Oh, thank you.
Excellent. We like hearing that. Was that it?
Okay, just a couple of things. I think it would be important for, as part of their taser training, for all police officers to be tasered.
Yes.
All right?
Yes.
Being it's humane and it's not lethal, I couldn't understand why a police officer would have a problem with being tasered so he could know what the citizen who gets tasered, sometimes indiscriminately, to see what it feels like.
You remember it made the front page of the Metro section when Sheriff Bernie Gusto allowed himself to be tasered during training.
Right.
So clearly it's not the norm if it makes the front page of the paper if the sheriff gets tased.
Right.
And it absolutely should be part of their taser training. And if there are any police officers listening, why don't you please call and give us your take on it?
You're absolutely... It's interesting that you bring up this point, because when we first started seeing tasers being put out onto the street and into police departments, it was a requirement for all police officers who are going to have a taser to be shot
to be tasered
and to be shot with a taser. But there are many police departments have moved back on that requirement and have made it voluntary because there have been some injuries to officers during training as they have been shot with tasers.
Oh, I see.
Some police departments actually do a different. They administer a shock. They put the officers actually in a circle, and so all the individuals are touching. They hold arms, and they send the shock through the circle. It's like a circle shock.
Right.
I've done that shock. And so that's what a lot of police forces do now, is that they do just that, a more benign shock. And it is voluntary at this point for officers to be shot with tasers in training.
I'm sorry, it shouldn't be voluntary. It should be mandatory. And if they stopped it because police officers were getting hurt.
Exactly. Isn't that evidence? Right.
Don't citizens get hurt too?
Well, we certainly believe that citizens get hurt with tasers. It points to the fact that there are still so many outstanding questions, both medical questions and use questions. And it's interesting, that we see police departments backing away from requiring a shock.
That is. What other points did you have to make?
Okay, just one more thing. It's all about intimidation, right? The reason that we have RoboCop is to intimidate the public. So the police officers, being they have to keep us in control, all right? They have to intimidate us, and so their humanity generally is in the toilet. They really don't care one way or another about us, obviously. Otherwise, Kendra James wouldn't have got gunned down in her car for no reason at all, right? And policemen who keep on taking a walk after they kill somebody. Look at that situation that just happened in Wisconsin, where an Afro-American man was nearly beaten to death by a group of police officers, right? who happen to be Caucasians and who happen to be drunk. And there were 12, 14 cops who damn near beat this man from a death.
Wow. I hadn't heard about that.
Yeah. The man's name is Jude, J-U-D-E. And Mumia did thing on it on his radio segment, and like it's a horror story.
Wow.
These police officers were acquitted. They were, every single one of them were acquitted. The emergency room doctors were saying they've never seen a man who was so severely beaten,
wow.
who actually lived.
Wow.
So Joanne, it's out of control.
Well, I mean, but you do raise a point. I mean, and I think that's one of the challenges from our perspective as community members. Mm-hmm. It's like if you watch over and over again where police, when they're if they are accused or if they are investigated, what we see as a community is that a police officer is never, ever, ever held accountable
never.
For their behavior as it relates to a civilian. And actually, I wanted to give Mona an opportunity to talk about the Perez killing.
Uh-huh.
Because Perez is an example of a man who was in an automobile and actually was tasered lots of times uh-huh. before he was ultimately shot by the police officer and killed.
Yeah, I remember.
And so here's an example of someone where it's sound, and this is broad daylight out in a high traffic area, lots of people around. People heard the command to get out of the car, and of course the investigation found the officers acted within the proper restraints of the police department. But from witnesses' testimonies, the man was trying to unlock his seatbelt,
mm-hmm.
right? And the perception was he was reaching for a weapon, so he was shot with the taser, and then ultimately shot and killed with a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you see a situation like that for most of the public. It seems pretty cut and dry, you know. If you want somebody to get out of an automobile, you should at least give them the opportunity to release their seatbelt before you start shooting them with items. And so, again, I don't believe that police officers are trained in de-escalation techniques anymore, if they ever were, because now it appears that the goal is to you do what I tell you to do, and if you don't, then you know, whatever happens, happens. And there's really no accountability for mm-hmm. taking somebody's life.
Mm-hmm.
No one should die because they didn't have a driver's license at a traffic stop.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody should die because they were asked to get out of a car and their seatbelt is stuck. But yet that happens over and over and over again in our community and across the country.
Right.
And you got to ask, how is it that we're allowing this to continue to happen?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I think the key things that you really bring up are the issue of real consequences.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, Amnesty International, I think members of the public want to see consequences. When the police misuse their weapon, when they misuse their authority, a slap on the wrist is not enough.
Right.
And we need to send the message to our police officers that they are there to serve and protect.
Right.
And we shouldn't be afraid of the police.
That's right.
And we shouldn't have to think that, you know, if for some reason my seatbelt gets stuck, I am in danger of being shot.
Right.
And so real consequences is a big piece. And I think it goes back again to the issue of training that we were talking about
uh-huh.
before. The better we train our police, the more they are clear and understand methods of de-escalation.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
I'll see if I can get you some water. You seem to have a tickle there.
The better they're going to be on the street.
Cool. We're going to go. Thank you very much. We appreciate your call as always.
Nothing to it, Joanne.
Have a fabulous day.
Thank
fight,
you.
Fight the good fight, Joanne.
You know it.
Joanne, you are absolutely an awesome woman.
Oh, you're a sweetheart. Thank you so much for calling.
Bye-bye.
Have a great day.
Well, you too.
It's nice to have some people out there that think you do good work. We're going to take the next caller. Good morning, caller. Welcome to K-Boo. They're going to go get you some water before you have to answer again, I promise. Hi, good morning. How are you today?
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
We're doing well, thanks. Unfortunately, Mona's about to choke to death, but other than that, we're doing really well here.
I was interested in what Tom Hastings was saying about those who exploit conflict and who actually prefer to exacerbate the conflict so that they can profit.
Yes.
And these tasers seem to be profiting somebody. My concern is that now I understand the Portland Police Department, every officer has been issued a taser gun. And the bottom line, if you think about what torture is, a taser gun is administering torture. So I don't even know if we should be allowed to use them at all. But, you know, James Perez, the man you were just talking about who was killed, he was tasered after he was shot.
Oh, that's right. I forgot that.
And the officer who tasered him was a man who was the partner, for the day only, of an officer who did shoot him within 24 seconds of stopping him. And I recently heard of a young man who had gone to a party and was driving home and realized he was tipsy. So he pulled off to the side of the road, got into the passenger seat, and fell asleep. He woke up to being tasered.
Whoa.
And I am...
Was that here?
Yes. And wow. I'm very concerned. And, of course, the intimidation factor causes people not to press complaints about these
right.
things. Because of somehow other things happen or come back on them when they do attempt to complain
you know,
loudly.
That's a catch-22 because it's right. like, it's one of those kind of things where, you know, people don't want to file the complaint because they don't believe anything will happen, or they believe the officer will be exonerated just because he's an officer, or they believe that there will be intimidation and repercussions from other officers on the street if they press that complaint. So that's like the citizen side, right?
Right.
On the other side, when as an activist who wants to make the police department better, when you go in and say, look, we know that citizens are being abused by police officers on the street, then they show the data and says, well, we only got X number of complaints,
right.
so clearly
right.
everything out there
but
is going...
But if you're in the citizen's shoes, you know, I remember witnessing this one young man and his friends being stopped on the street one evening, and several police officers got out of the car and were talking to him, and then they left. And my friend and I went over to ask him what that was all about, and he said, oh, they just stopped it. Oh, no, we asked an officer that was standing by. Oh, they're just congratulating him on winning his case. Now,
oh.
that's not intimidation. I don't know what is, you know. And I think that we need to establish a safe forum for people in order to do that before mm-hmm. we ask people to put themselves in that kind of jeopardy. And
well,
we haven't quite done that yet.
Well, now, if I remember, didn't we put police complaint forms and community-based organizations like the Urban League and the food bank places, and didn't we
right.
move them
but
out
is
of
that
the
a safe forum?
I'm sorry?
Is that a safe forum? Do people feel comfortable and safe filing those complaints?
Well, I think what you're asking is, so what happens after? So it's like
right.
it's fine to go to a community place organization and fill out the application.
Right.
But ultimately, you've got to interact with the police department in order to get any kind of justice for your complaint,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And so you do raise a valid question. So should there be an independent entity, a
right.
community-based organization that's
or
contracted?
Amnesty International or something.
Or Amnesty International.
Something that has... some authority.
That's an interesting, I like that idea. And I don't know if you were listening earlier when I talked about these community listening sessions that are coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully,
yeah, I heard about that.
Oh, good. So hopefully
when is the first one?
The first one is going to be May 18th. Don't know where it's going to be yet, but it's going to be every week for 5 weeks, one in each of the precinct areas. I believe the first one is actually going to take place in a Lentz area.
Okay, so but then we need to really consider this whole notion of what tasers are and what they're used mm-hmm. for. And your guest has spoken about that quite extensively.
Yes, she has. She's very articulate on that topic.
Okay.
Thank you so much for your call today.
Bye.
Have a great day. We got lots of callers, but Mona, you've riled them up. They want to talk. They want to demand action, and I love it. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KVU.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
Wonderful. Thank you.
So I got a question, and then I got a comment. First
all right.
of all, my question is this. Going to the chief of police and asking her to modify some type of police behavior to me is like the little boy with his thumb in the dike. Seemed like to me you would go to the legislature and try to get them to put laws in place that regulate the police, because, you know, going to the chief of police is like going to Jesse James asking him to do something about Frank. That don't make sense. My next question...
Okay, we'll hold that one. Go
okay,
ahead.
My next comment is first of all, understanding... the police mission, they're paramilitary, and their mission basically is involved in class warfare, because when they tase people, it's a select group of people. It's minorities, poor people, mentally ill people, a group of people that most society don't care about anyway. And so also from that group of people, the police or the criminal system derive slave labor, because when they put you in the system, they work you for nothing, and they out cleaning up the highways and all of that stuff. And also, too, a lot of medical experiment goes on once you get locked up. They experiment with what they call it behavior modification stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of stuff emanates from what the police do on a grand scale. And to me, it would seem like if the police was really, or if society was interested in doing some serious policing, they would have more social workers out on the front lines, which I think if social workers was out there, there would be less need for policing. So they don't care about the people. And so I just wanted to throw that out there to you.
Thank you. You know, I want to be able to contact you. You were going to send me your info, and you never did. So
I left it with the guy up the front. Maybe he just didn't give it to you.
I never got it, no. But okay. I would love to contact you. But we're going to go through some of the points that you made, because I certainly want you involved in these community listening sessions, because I think you will bring a powerful perspective. So let's go back to the gentleman started off talking about the fact that what was the first point? I'm sorry, I'm blanking.
Chief of police, essentially.
Oh, right,
like
versus
the
legislature.
The
right. The chief of police versus the legislative change. I guess my response to that would be, if you could get one police chief within Oregon to agree that they should modify or change how tasers are used, then you can help spread it around the state. My experience with trying to pass police reform, especially in the legislative body, is it's such an uphill battle because, you know, you've got the Sheriff's Association, the Police Officers Association, and those and a lot of law enforcement folks who spend all their time full-time in Salem every legislative session trying to pass more mandatory minimum laws, trying to create more barriers, trying to create more laws on the books to create more criminal behavior, that if a citizen group was down trying to pass some meaningful reform, they would be shut out of the process.
Right, and I think it's also, you know, it's a two-handed, you know, or a two-way street in that we need to go to chiefs of police, but that needs to happen in conjunction with going to the legislature. And just as mm-hmm. Joanne says, when we have one chief of police who's willing to go to the legislature and mm-hmm. said, here are methods that are working. Mm-hmm. Our incidences of use of force are dropping because right. we are changing the way we are policing our street.
Exactly.
That makes a difference. And that, unfortunately, speaks volumes mm-hmm. when a police chief is willing to stand up and say,
that's right.
this is what is working mm-hmm. for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's important that we hit on all sides. And in addition mm-hmm. to citizen groups, I think, you know, one group that hasn't been mentioned is Portland Cop Watch.
Right.
And they also have a tip line that if there are police incidences, you mm-hmm. can call.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were talking to the chief of police, Dan was bringing up incidences and saying, hey, we know that these kinds of things have happened.
Right.
And the first thing that they asked us is, did they file a report?
Right.
And you know, Portland Cop Watch, they provide the citizens opportunities and say, here's how you can deal
right.
with your complaint.
Right.
They don't force anybody to go to the police.
That's right.
So a lot of those reports don't get sent into the police. So the police, they don't know.
Right.
Unless it's officially filed with
right.
them, then they don't know. So then we sort of go back to the previous caller's
right.
question about, you know, retribution and
exactly.
what happens when you file a report.
Right.
And I think these community listening sessions
mm-hmm.
are a great way
mm-hmm.
for the community to be able to come out and
mm-hmm.
feel like they're in a safe space
mm-hmm.
and say, you know, here's how the police are affecting my daily life.
Mm-hmm.
And here's how we think we as citizens can work with the police. Because I think
right.
it's important that
right.
to be able to to stand up and say, we want to work with you because you are our police and you are part of making our community better.
Right.
And that those community listening sessions, everybody needs to go to those sessions and stand up and be counted because this is where you're going to be able to make change. And if the police chief is willing to hear, that's such a huge step.
I agree with that. I also didn't want to lose the point about the free labor of prisoners because, you know, there's this chain link impact,
right?
From the police officer on the street to what happens at the state correctional facilities. And what you may not know, Mona, that in Oregon, we have a law that requires inmates to work 40 hours a week.
It is a law.
It's a statutory law in Oregon. So, which means that there are a lot of prison industries whereby somebody's making a lot of money off of the labor of folks that are incarcerated, and the state is aggressively seeking these contracts with private business owners. And one example is there used to be living wage jobs doing laundry. You know, it used to be a lot of big laundry for hotels and schools and those kind of things, and now they're all done exclusively by prison laborers. And so you think about how living wage jobs have now, the companies who own those companies now are making significant profit because they're paying about 12 cents an hour for people to do the work rather than living wage benefits, et cetera, all attached to it. So it's that's life in Oregon.
Right. Yeah, and I think that also really points to when we look as we get to a more retributive style you know, of justice, you know, let's lock people up and have them, you know, do these menial tasks. So when you do get released, you haven't learned a
skill.
And, you know, you don't have anything to contribute back to the society because all, you know, it sounds like in Oregon, okay, maybe I'm arrested and I'm put in prison. Okay, I spend 5 years doing laundry. I'm released. There's no industry for me to go into.
No industry for laundry. Absolutely true. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Let me tell you what's coming up today on KABU. At 9, it's Recovery Zone, a pilot program by Stephanie Potter. Her guest is local activist Marsha Myers of In Corporate Personhood. At 9:30, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10 on Radio Beyond Borders, hear a documentary called We Are Americans, which explores the lives of immigrants and refugees in Oregon, produced by award-winning producer Mia Kim. At 10:30 on Art Focus, Julie Bernard speaks with local painter Peggy Persak Collins. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, John Dean and Daniel Ellsberg speak on Watergate and the abuse of presidential power from Nixon to Bush, and a look at the life and death of a renowned Mexican human rights lawyer. That's what's coming up today on KBOO. In addition, if you've got some free time today, we need your help down here at the KBOO studio. We are going to be doing our monthly listener guide mailing party. So today, starting at 9 a.m., come on down to the studio, which is at 20 Southeast 8th, and help us put those listener guides into the mail. If you want more info, give us a call at 503-231-8032. That's what's coming up today at KBOO. Back to the phone line. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Oh, thank you, Joanne.
You're welcome.
Well, you know, you're talking about the tasers or, you know, anything else that's used as whatever it's used for, punishment, you know, grab them, whatever. Not just try it out on the police who are the most direct in using these, but they ought to be tried on up the line with all of the people involved in policy making.
I like this. Let's line up our legislative body.
A lot of things. Because you know what I see in our society, because I feel quite disenfranchised. And what I see is that the higher people are on the, quote, food chain, whether they're in the corporados or the federales, the higher they are up, the less accountability they have.
Right. That's a really good point. Until we
and
take
at the very top, there's absolutely no damn accountability. And we see that on a daily basis. They lie, they cheat, they steal.
That's true.
And when the American people can realize that there really is a they, there really is a they.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little core of elite power mongers. And that's, you know, it's kind of like wars are for making money. Okay, who's making the money?
Exactly.
We see in our media, yeah, they talk about Halliburton, but I never see anything in the media, or perhaps I miss it, about the Carlyle Group and who is involved in the Carlyle Group.
They sure don't, do they?
No,
no, they don't.
It's amazing how that information just gets left out.
Well, there's so much information that is left out, you know, and it's just, it's so frustrating. And these, I don't know what to call, cretins, I guess, are getting away with all this.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your call, and I share your frustration, but I refuse to be disenfranchised.
This
is my country, this is my state, and I'm not letting them get away with it. So,
right. And that's really our call to action. I mean, you know, the angrier we are and the more we want to see change, the more incentive it is for us to get involved. And,
yes.
You know, if you're in town tomorrow, 4 o'clock at Pioneer Square, we are having a demonstration looking specifically at the issue of torture and
mm-hmm.
rendition. And we will be talking about, you know, what's happening. How is the U.S. government complicit in torture? And there's actually going to be...
They are totally, you know, they're devising it.
And then there's a lot of great speakers. There's actually an attorney who's representing a detainee at Guantanamo, and he, you know, talks about his challenges of actually representing someone in Guantanamo.
That you can't communicate with. That,
right, it takes six
that,
weeks to get information.
Keep in mind that, you know, like I say, the federales are never wrong, nor are the corporados.
That's true, but you know,
they are never wrong.
There are opportunities for us to change that. So hopefully you will.
Thank you so much.
You are very welcome. You have a fabulous day, okay?
Thank you.
Okay. Now, so Friday at 4 at Pioneer Square is going to be the March Against Torture.
That's right.
And there are other ways for people to get involved with your activities this weekend?
Absolutely.
Lots of workshops, lots of speakers.
Lots of workshops throughout the weekend on various issues, looking at, you know, from the Women of Juarez to torture to trauma working group to the Niger Delta to the illegal arms trade to the death penalty, human rights and accountability, all kinds of stuff. You can come, you can register for the whole weekend
mm-hmm.
on the website amnestyusa.org, or if you want to just come on Saturday, which is when the bulk of the workshops are, you can actually just walk in and pay $20 for a day pass.
Uh-huh.
And we're at the Hilton on Southwest 6th Avenue,
yes.
And so we definitely would love to have everybody come on by. But the rally is open to everybody. It's free, 4 o'clock, Pioneer Square tomorrow.
Yeah, and we like doing rallies on Friday afternoon downtown Portland.
Well, we thought it would be great. There's the Amnesty at 4, and we know there's a regular anti-war 5 o'clock, so
that's
we thought
right.
we'd come down for a double shot. And
excellent.
You know, we definitely want to see you spend our weekend with us.
I so appreciate you being here, Mona. You are a wealth of information.
My pleasure.
I love your energy. We've got one last caller. We're going to try to squeak in, if, in fact, we can get this caller to keep their comments to 1 minute or less. Hi, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to say I used to own a business that carried Prison Blues until I dug into it and found out the information that it was a huge company,
yes,
prison-based company, so I just cleared them out and said no more. So people don't buy Prison Blues.
Good for you. Good for you. That's
Thank
a
you.
Perfect example of something
mm-hmm.
that was marketed, and most people had no idea that there were
right.
really people in prison putting those jeans together. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank
Have
you.
A great day.
You too.
And just one more thing, getting involved in Amnesty, you can come for the weekend and go to the conference, but we actually have a local group in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
It's local group number 48, and you can find the information about them on the website, amnestyusa.org, or you can always call us in the San Francisco office, which is 415-291-9233, and we're happy to hook you up with group 48 here in Portland, and they meet monthly.
Wonderful. And so tell me, if somebody locally wanted to get involved,
mm-hmm.
what kind of opportunities exist with Amnesty International for people to help educate themselves and get involved in trying to make the world better?
Well, the first is there's a wealth of information on the website with
mm-hmm.
just every single topic, all the countries you can imagine. Mm-hmm. There's information there. We have our local group that meets monthly, and then there's various volunteer leader positions. People, if you're interested in legislative work, or mm-hmm. if you're interested in women or corporate mm-hmm. accountability, mm-hmm. there are leadership positions where you can be a volunteer organizer for Amnesty mm-hmm. here in Portland, in Oregon, and do that kind of work. So call us in the San Francisco office, and we're happy to connect you and get you involved. So
wonderful.
There's always space for everyone.
Well, I want to once again really thank Mona for being here. It's been a wonderful conversation, and I still think you ought to move to Portland. I mean, San Francisco's nice. I lived in San Francisco, but, you know, I really think you need to move to Portland. This has been a fabulous program today, and actually, we covered a lot of territory. You were here when the last shuffle
right.
was taking place, but we started this morning talking to Charlie Burr with voter-owned elections, which you may know we're the first city in the country to pass a voter-owned election system at the city council mm-hmm. level. And we're in the process of having our first election cycle with candidates using the voter-owned election system. And then we moved into talking to Tom Hastings about the upcoming peace conference that will be taking place on May 5th and 6th at Portland Community College, Building Cultures of Peace, at Portland Community College Cascade Campus. And if you want more information on that, you could check the website at www.peaceandconflictstudies.org for the voter-owned elections. For more information, you can go to www.friendsofvoteonthevoe.org, friendsofvoe.org. And for Amnesty International, you can go to
amnestyusa.org.
Excellent. So thank you all so much for coming in and allowing us to come into your place of business, your car, your home this morning. And we'll see you, or I'll see you next week. Same time, same place, same channel. Have a fabulous day.
Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Good morning. This is the Thursday morning radio zine for April 27th. Coming up this morning on KABU at 9, it's Recovery Zone, a pilot program by Stephanie Potter. Her guest is local activist Marsha Myers of End Corporate Personhood. At 9:30, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10 on Radio Beyond Borders, hear a documentary called We Are Americans, which explores the lives of immigrants and refugees in Oregon, produced by award-winning producer Mia Kim. At 10:30 on Art Focus, Julie Bernard speaks with local painter Peggy Prusak-Collins. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, John Dean and Daniel Ellsberg speak on Watergate and the abuse of President